funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to tell the world's most important stories? In an era when Americans are often criticized for paying more attention to what happens within our own borders than to the fates of those who live far away, the work of international journalists is essential to our ability to truly understand the broader world and our role within it. Journalist Lisa Ling believes passionately in the value of such reporting and has been engaged in it since she was a teenager. Her work has taken her to some of the planet's most dangerous places, including Iraq, Afghanistan, and North Korea, as well as multiple countries in Africa. Next Sunday, National Geographic Explorer will debut her special report from the blood-soaked drug wars along the U.S.-Mexico border. She's in town to appear tonight at 8 at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas as part of the Brinker International Forum series. Lisa, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Nice to see you.
You've said there aren't enough people telling the world's stories. Why do you think that's the case?
It's not for lack of people wanting to tell the stories. I think that broadcast news has become a very, for lack of a better word, ugly environment. There's so much competition. There are news networks that are on 24 hours a day needing to fill programming. Budgets are getting cut. And there's an assumption that people, Americans, don't care about what's going on in the world. And I categorically disagree with that notion. The problem is that the highest rated shows on a lot of these cable networks consists of these old guys yelling at you and telling you what to think. And the shows will bring on the most conservative right-wing mouthpiece and the most liberal left-wing mouthpiece and let them fight it out and call that news. And the audience, by default, I think, just consumes whatever is being offered to them. I think that if our news outlets really spent the time and covered differently and comprehensively a lot of the things that were happening in the world, I really do think people would respond. But instead, we do wall-to-wall Tiger Woods Octomom stories on our quote-unquote news shows.
And it is remarkable how much of what we call journalism today is really personality-driven. If you think about, you know, Edward R. Murrow, he wasn't giving you his opinion ever.
Right. And that's the thing. These shows, the fact that they call themselves news is really befuddling to me, because they're very much opinion shows. Entire networks are very much opinion networks. And that's disturbing. I wish they would just call themselves for what they are. And unfortunately, because there's so much information out there, I think the public just, at a certain point, just wants to be told what to think. I don't know that I want to sit and try and understand these complex things where you can have a guy kind of yelling and telling you what to think, and it's just easier.
How do you decide what stories you're going to pursue? Because you don't have, like, even a regional beat. You're all over the planet.
I read pretty voraciously, and I'm constantly pitching stories to the various organizations for which I work. And I would say that a quarter of the stories that I pitch, I'm allowed to do. I'm very lucky because my main job is for the Oprah show, but I obviously can't work. I can't do pieces for her show every day, so they allow me to contribute to National Geographic still and Nightline and other networks. And so between the three, I have a pretty good chance at getting some of those stories made.
Does the relative danger of a story ever play into your assessment of whether or not you should go?
Absolutely. We certainly, before every story, do a risk assessment. And, for example, I recently worked on a series for CNN called Planet in Peril, and we visited Nigeria. And there was a lot of powwowing and meetings and security concerns that we took under serious consideration. But for me, I go to a lot of these countries or places because a lot of these stories that I do are domestic. And I go and I spend a couple of weeks max, and then I come home to my home in Los Angeles. But the people who have to live under those kinds of conditions have to do so every day of their lives. And so if I can somehow communicate a fraction of what their lives and their stories are like, then that's what I really try to do.
What kind of preparation do you undertake before you go? Once you, someone has said, okay, we'll pay for this, and now you have to get ready.
I try and read as much as I can about the place. Our whole team will go back and forth between the things that we need to bring, the things that we need to be prepared for. So I would say a decent amount of preparation goes into every story. One of the things I'll talk about tonight at the Performing Arts Center is the reason why I love my job so much is I always go into every story with a very defined, preconceived idea of what the people are going to be like, what the story is going to be like, what the food is going to taste like. And inevitably, as soon as I hit the ground, I realize that it's not what I thought it was going to be, and that no story is so black and white. And that's what I love about it, that process of discovery. And that's when I think journalists do their best work.
It's interesting that you say you still go into it with a preconceived notion. It makes sense to me, but it would seem to people like, well, you shouldn't have any preconceived notions. I guess you can't even form the scaffolding for what you're going to do if you don't at least think you know what you're going to get.
Yeah, I read so much about every story that contributes to that preconceived notion. But nothing can ever really prepare you for what will happen on the ground. I mean, life is unpredictable. But you or I like to be as armed as possible going into every story. But I always know that in the end, the way I perceive things going into it will probably change a lot.
Are there times when the magnitude of your personal experience in covering this are really hard to translate once you're sitting there trying to cut tape?
Always. And what I try to do in my work, and I think that my work looks and feels a little different from a lot of other journalism shows and segments. I try and provide the viewer with an experience. So if I'm about to go into a prison and feeling a little uneasy about it, then I'll tell the camera that. Because I want the viewer to even feel what I'm feeling as I'm about to embark upon a situation or a story. And that's not to say I'm telling them what to think. There's a big difference. It really is, I'm going to try to bring you along on this experience so that you can therefore kind of make a decision one way or another about what you think about the story. And that's all I really try to do, is give viewers an experience and not editorialize and tell them, what to think about it.
How often are you in a situation where you feel like you have to protect your notes or whatever you've gathered electronically from, seizure by the local authorities?
It's certainly happened a few times. When I went to Nigeria, I mean, I'm thinking about this story most recently because that's the one where I had to, I did all my research on the plane, and then I shredded everything before I actually got to Nigeria, because we didn't want the government to know that we were actually going to be meeting up with the rebels. So just to try and do everything that we could to protect our sources and not reveal what we were going to be doing is certainly important. It doesn't happen every time, but it doesn't really warrant that every time.
Do you try to work with the same crew every time?
I actually work with different crews most of the time, and that way it helps me learn about different styles and so on. So I really enjoy it. There are certain producers who are my favorite. I won't mention who they are in case they're listening. But I actually enjoy working with different teams.
The last time you were here on the show, we were talking about a National Geographic special that you had done, and you had sort of snuck into North Korea undercover. It looked like you were part of a team that was going to perform eye surgeries from China.
Right.
And it was a fascinating story, and it was really difficult for you to get there and to get out without anyone knowing what you were doing.
Right.
And then, of course, the whole world sort of followed the story of your sister, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, who were apprehended in North Korea. Did you talk with her before she went about, did you give her sort of your impressions and what to watch out for?
Well, a couple things. I didn't sneak in with the medical delegation. I went in officially. I just didn't say I was a journalist. I went in as part of the medical team to document the sort of teaching process, because the doctor I went with, a cataract surgeon from Nepal, was also a teaching doctor.
Thank you for the correction. Actually.
Oh, no problem. And it was an incredibly eye-opening experience, because I'd never encountered that level of isolation before in my life. I mean, North Korea is this tiny country that stands in defiance of the rest of the world. And what we did there ended up being part of a very critical documentary about the North Korean regime. And I never thought that my family or I would have any dealings with North Korea ever again. And yes, you're right. The whole world watched as my sister was detained, sentenced, and then returned back to America from North Korea. And she and I had talked about it a lot. But when she left the United States to do the story about the trafficking of women from North Korea into China, there was never any intention of actually going into North Korea. The intention was just to interview people in Seoul, South Korea, and to interview some people, prearranged interviews actually, on the China-North Korea border, but on the China side. So what happened the day of their arrest was something that just happened so so unexpectedly, really. And what I'll say, because I don't want to talk too much about my sister's situation, because I want to let her tell that story. But as journalists, we travel all over the world and we hire people we call fixers to help us navigate.
Local.
Exactly. I mean, I do this for almost every country that I visit. And to our, I think that we journalists actually sometimes put too much trust and faith in these fixers, because they are locals, and I will never work with a fixer who has never worked with journalists before. The same was true for my sister. He's someone who had done work for the BBC, for various international news networks, so they trusted him. And that day, circumstances happened, and they ended up arrested on the Chinese side of that border.
By the North Koreans.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The last thing I'll ask, is she doing okay now?
She's doing great. Thank you. Yeah, she's doing great. And my family just got a tremendous gift in her return, because there's a good chance she could still be there right now. But we got very, very lucky. And through the course of some very cautious diplomacy, we're able to get her out.
From your perspective, or from, you know, your mom or your husband, did this make them think, that's it, you're never going anywhere again? And
right.
I know you're 36 years old, but, you know, there's that instinct.
Certainly my mom and dad would rather us do other work. They've always felt that way. My mom loved when I was on The View because she could see me every
you're
day.
Safe in that chair.
Exactly. And her biggest concern was like what my hair looked like or what I was wearing on The View. And now, you know, I'll call her from Nigeria or India. I think my sister is doing a lot of reevaluating, because she and her husband were wanting to start a family soon anyway. And again, this was supposed to be a week and a half long trip that ended up being nearly 5 months. For me, on the other hand, yes, I'm 36 years old, but I just feel like there's so much world to cover. There's so many stories to cover. And I feel even more fired up, quite honestly, to cover stories. I mean, even though we have so many networks out there that are purportedly doing news, not a lot of them really are covering it comprehensively and well. And I've been afforded the opportunity to continue doing a lot of this kind of work, and I want to try and do it as long as I can. I mean, I don't consider it work. I mean, it's something that I'm deeply, deeply passionate about, and it completely, I don't know, I feel like a lot of the work that I've been able to do has changed people's perception, and in some cases, I think changed people's lives. I worked on a story for the Oprah show.
Okay. Oh, sorry, let me
take
a quick break. Lisa
sure.
Ling is with us. She's a journalist who's in town to host the Brinker International Forum tonight at 8 at the Winspear Opera House. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Lisa Ling. She's in town as a guest of the Brinker International Forum. She'll speak tonight at 8 at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, you were telling us that you, you're not ready to stop because there's so many places that you still want to go.
Yeah, and I said that I believe that the work that I've been able to do has changed lives. And what I wanted to say about that is, and I'll use an example. A couple of years ago, I worked on a story for The Oprah Show about the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's a war that has been going on for over a decade, and millions of people have been killed by guerrilla armies from surrounding countries. And the most devastating victims are women, because on any given night, women in villages will be ravaged by bands of guerrilla armies and gang raped in front of their families, in front of their children. And it's a story that still continues to haunt me to this day. And when the Oprah Show sent me to cover it, they did so because they felt like this is a story that we just need to be covering, because it's a catastrophic thing that's happening to women in this country. We never thought it was going to get any kind of rating, but it turned out that 9 million people watched that episode of television that day, which was a huge number for the Oprah Show, and in one episode of television raised $2.5 million for women's organizations that were operating in the area to try and give women a chance to build themselves back up again. And by the third or fourth time that episode aired in a couple of years, it had raised over $5 million. And so to say that Americans don't care about what's happening in the world, to me, is just utterly false, because I do believe women, people, want to know what's happening. And I know that so many women's lives were changed as a result of people in America just caring.
Is it hard, though, to come back from an assignment like that and turn on sort of regular news and we're talking about, you know, this week it's Tiger Woods or it's, right, you know, Britney Spears or things that really don't matter except to the people directly involved?
It is hard, and I don't want to get high and mighty and sound self-righteous, because I've gotten this opportunity and it's a very unique one. I wish that our quote-unquote news organizations would cover them just even a bit more than they are. Like, let's cut down a little bit of the Tiger coverage. And, you know, it's not like anyone's reporting any new information when it's on ad nauseum. So it's a little frustrating on that front, because there are people dying. There are people being raped in front of their children. And it's been going on for more than 10 years. I mean, if the world banded together, if people in this country banded together, there's a good chance we could put a dent in it. But I guess that's just the way it is. But that's one of the main reasons why I still feel like I want to continue doing this kind of work, because I have gotten this chance. And if I can continue to tell these kinds of stories, I really want to try and do it. I feel like I'd be remiss if I just kind of gave up on it.
Is it hard to be away from home so much?
It is. It's very hard. And now that I'm married, for the last 2.5 years, it's even harder. In the past, even though I'd been in relationships before, if my work said, okay, we need you to stay in India for another month, I'd be perfectly fine with it, because I love being on the road. But now that I'm married to someone I actually love and like, it is hard. But he knew going into marriage with me that this is my passion.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is journalist Lisa Ling, who's in town for the Brinker International Forum tonight at the Winspear Opera House. Let's speak to Amanda in Fort Worth. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
Hi, Amanda. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Hi, Lisa. I've been a fan of yours since The View, and I actually didn't realize your journalistic talent until The Oprah Show. That's been really great to watch.
And, oh, thanks.
Yeah, I just, you know, wish there were more of them like that, more like you on TV. But my question is, what types of relationships, if any, have you formed with your subjects? And particularly, I'm thinking of maybe your contact with the FLDS or the family in Ohio that was addicted to heroin. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
It's a great question. I probably get a little bit too attached to a lot of the people on whom I report. people joke because my wedding, we had 600 people at the wedding. And yeah, a lot of them were family and friends, but like the couple whose house blew away during Hurricane Katrina in Mississippi was at our wedding. A bunch of the families who I accompanied to adopt Chinese daughters were there at the wedding. And in fact, today I'm bringing a young girl from Las Vegas who has been a teenage prostitute since she was very, very young to a home in Pasadena because she's finally ready to leave Las Vegas. It's a toxic city and situation for her because her mother was involved in prostitution. Her grandmother was a drug addict, and I've been in touch with her and kind of mentoring her for the last few years and essentially begging her to get out of Las Vegas because it's so toxic. And I finally got her to agree. So today, as we speak, as a matter of fact, I think my mom's picking her up at Burbank Airport and taking her to Pasadena, because it is really hard when you do a lot of these stories and people trust you enough to share things with you that they don't even tell their own families. I often feel like I have a responsibility to a lot of these people. You asked about the family in Ohio. I became friends with Mike Hawk, who was the father of the family addicted to heroin. And he was on a really positive path for a year. And I talked to him on the phone once a week. And the problem with Mike was that even though he was on a positive path, the rest of his family was still deeply involved in drugs. And it's difficult to stay clean when the rest of your family is on heroin. If you care about your family and you want to help them, then inevitably you'll be exposed to heroin as well. And so I think that Mike probably, I haven't heard from him in about 2 months. I actually ended up giving him a little bit of money and then I stopped hearing from him, which makes me really sad because the truth of the matter is I don't even know if he's alive right now, but I just am praying that he's okay and not back into drugs, but unfortunately I think he probably has taken a divergent path. But yeah, it's sometimes I wish I wouldn't get as involved with a lot of my subjects, but I just, you know, it's hard to turn your back on people, especially when they are in periods of tremendous need and when they've really opened their lives to you. As far as the FLDS, I haven't really been in touch with a lot of people from the FLDS, though.
In all the work that I've seen of yours, you are extraordinarily respectful of people's individual dignity. But there is still, in this business that we're in, there's a certain amount of exploitation, and I don't use that in the cruelest sense of the word, of a human being's personal story. Yeah. How much do you struggle with the fact that even if you're telling the truth, and even if someone comes to you willingly and trusts you, and you are careful, that they'll be open to scrutiny by other people who may not understand the story as well as you do?
I try and let people know that once you go on television and share these aspects of your stories, it's your life will be different forever. I was just reporting on this homeless family in California that had never been homeless before. The mother and father both had very successful businesses in real estate, and both of their businesses collapsed. And they hadn't told a lot of people. They hadn't told a lot of their friends and teachers of their son that they were homeless. And so I said, are you sure? Because once you appear on television, everyone will know. And they actually said that they, one, found the experience to be cathartic, but they wanted to be an example to people who have become homeless for the first time. That they were just normal, hardworking people and the bottom just fell out from underneath them. But we definitely, I mean, I try really hard to convey what the possible scenarios will be like. And all I can really do is try and treat my subjects as respectfully as I can. That's all I really can do. If they agree to tell their stories, I hope that, that I am able to tell them with dignity.
Lisa Ling is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Yeah, you had mentioned that there were guerrilla armies coming in from outside the country, and I just wondered if you had any inkling, you know, who was supplying these people and Are they serving some foreign business interest in the Congo? And I'll take my answer off or on the air.
Right. Thanks. It's a very, very complicated question, and the guerrilla armies that are penetrating the Congo are from Rwanda, from Uganda, other parts of Africa. Who is funding them definitively? I don't think anyone really knows the definitive answer, but the truth of the matter is that the DRC is hugely, hugely rich in natural resources. I mean, it is incredibly abundant. It's rich in diamonds. It's rich in gold. It's rich in a substance, I believe, called coltan that is used in cell phones. And so there may be business interests that are fueling some of these guerrilla armies. But at the end of the day, and this is a hard thing for people to hear, but at the end of the day, when we consume a lot of these resources without knowing specifically where the diamonds, the gold is coming from, the answer to that question is we are feeling that conflict, or people who are consuming it, those kinds of resources are feeling that conflict. I stopped wearing diamonds after my trip to the Congo. I mean, it was so devastating. I can't even put into words the things that I saw and the things that I heard in the Congo and the degree to which women were ravaged. And so I couldn't continue to wear diamonds. Now, I would never begrudge anyone for wanting to wear diamonds, but because I saw it with my own eyes, it became really difficult for me to do it.
You know, what's really interesting about that, Lisa, is that it's so easy for us as Americans to not know that, to not feel complicit in our cell phones and in, you know, our jewelry and things like that. We, you know, jewelry mm-hmm. comes from the jewelry store.
Sure.
And the cell phones come from AT&T.
Absolutely. And it's totally a personal decision. Again, I just would never begrudge anyone. First of all, you could be incredibly meticulous about knowing where your diamonds are coming from. And there is a process. You know, you could be certain that your diamonds are coming from India or from Canada or wherever. But just for me, just given what I experienced, and also, you know, I think there's so much sort of stigma attached to diamonds in this country. You know, I was engaged years ago to a man who gave me a very big diamond for our engagement. And people would see this ring on my hand and they'd come up and say, oh, we love him, love him. And I thought to myself, you love him. You've never met him. You only love him because he gave me a big rock. And I just thought that, I don't know. I sort of felt like there's too much influence put on this stone over which so much conflict is fueled in the world that I just... on a personal note, just decided to stop. But for people who you know, wouldn't make that decision, more power to you. I would never condemn anyone for not. I mean, I worked on a story for the Oprah show about puppy mills. And I'm a dog lover. I had heard of puppy mills but never known what they were like until I went and did the story. Now, when you buy puppies from pet stores, there is a strong chance that it may have come from one of these puppy mills. And when I went in undercover into these puppy mills, it was one of the most devastating experiences that I've ever had, particularly because I'm a dog lover. I cried for 2 days after because I would see these female dogs in these cages, and they'd spend their entire lives in this cage just reproducing and procreating and not even able to walk. When they would be rescued by these organizations, they'd bring the dog out of the cage, and the dog couldn't even walk. It didn't know how to walk because it had been living in this cage all of its life. And I hope that a story like that raises consciousness and makes people think when they buy dogs, period, when they buy dogs from puppy stores, or maybe it'll give people more incentive to rescue dogs.
Lisa Ling is my guest. She's in town for the Brinker International Forum. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to LaDonna in Plano. Hey, LaDonna.
Yes?
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. I'm LaDonna Castro, and I've had the opportunity to work with Lisa Ling. That's why I'm so happy that she's here in Dallas. Years ago, she inspired me as a mentor for
LaDonna.
Hi.
Hey, Mama. How are you?
I'm good.
Did you get married?
I'm so happy.
Did you get married?
I got married.
Okay, so
I'm
like, I only know one LaDonna, but her name's not Castro.
Yeah, no, it's Castro now.
Congratulations. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very, very good. And from the day that, you know, you were my mentor years ago, I too was inspired to travel the world. I now speak 5 languages, been to various, you know, countries around the world. I have 2 children. We still travel. I want to incorporate, you know, give them those learning opportunities around the world and, you know, show them, be a good role model to them. So I was wondering, A, how can I continue to do journalism kind of internationally with children, and do you have plans for children in your future?
It's so great to hear from you, sweetie, and I'm so proud of you and delighted to hear that travel became a passion for you as well. Chris and I were just having this conversation about children because I'm 36 years old and I feel that clock ticking, not because I want it to be clicking, it's just ticking. It's hard, and that's another reason why I feel like I want to do as much as I can, because I've been given this chance to do it before my husband and I go down that road. I don't think it's impossible by any means, and in fact, some of the most well-rounded people that I know are people whose parents took them to travel as kids. So if you can do that, I encourage it, because it will open your kids up to worlds that they would have never imagined if they didn't have a chance to travel. But LaDonna is a perfect example of a young person who, given the opportunity to know about things that are happening in the world, she seized it. And I think that if more young people in America had that chance, if they were encouraged to travel and be in other worlds, it just opens up your world. You become a different person. And frankly, you become a much more employable person because your perspective will be so widened.
Lisa Ling is my guest. She is a journalist, and she's in town for the Brinker International Forum tonight at 8 at the Winspear Opera House. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Lisa Ling. She has a National Geographic Explorer special debuting Sunday night at 8. It is about, it's called Explorer Narco State. You can see that on the National Geographic channel. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about this because, you know, we here in Texas are very concerned about what's taking place on the border. What did you find there?
Well, I actually spent a lot of time in Phoenix, and I think here in Dallas, the show's going to air at 7 on National Geographic.
Oh, the Central
Time.
8
o'clock Eastern, okay. Yeah. Phoenix has become the kidnapping capital of the United States, and it is directly related to the violence that's been spilling over from Mexico. In fact, when I was there in Phoenix, it was almost as though I was dealing with a situation that I would have dealt with in Mexico, because the drugs and money are flowing north from Mexico, and the guns and other weapons are flowing south from the United States into Texas. And in the midst of these transactions comes kidnapping. If certain people aren't paid, or if a ransom is being demanded from some of the drug dealers or gun smugglers and so on, and it's taking a big toll on the city of Phoenix. And so they've appointed this entire team that, as soon as a kidnapping investigation begins, this team tries to solve it within 48 hours. And they've had a fair amount of success with this. But it's a city that's really going through a lot right now, and it's a very clear example of that major conflict that's happening in Mexico, and it is starting to spill over. And the thing that is really disturbing that I don't think we think about enough in America is that there are far more people being killed just over the border in Mexico in cities like Juarez than in Baghdad or Kabul. And the reason why it's of such a concern is that right now we are preparing to deploy more troops in Afghanistan, and we are so heavily invested in conflicts overseas, but just over our own border is one that is raging. And it's already starting to bleed into the United States. And if something isn't done soon, it certainly could become an even bigger problem.
Well, I'm really interested to watch the special, and I haven't seen an advanced copy, but in that people aren't talking that much about how this is changing the culture. I grew up in El Paso, and mm-hmm. so El Paso and Juarez are, they're sister cities, but people are back and forth literally every single day. Yeah. And my understanding from family who still live there is that people aren't traveling. People are afraid to go out in some cases, and it's just changing the nature of day-to-day life.
It is, and what we're trying to project in this documentary is just to give people a sense of the conflict and how the violence in Mexico is spilling over. And really what we're trying to say is, look, we need to start focusing some attention on this, because it's true. I was in El Paso pretty recently, and you're right, people are not traveling across the border. When I would visit El Paso years ago, we would go over to Juarez for
party
a meal.
On.
Yeah. That's not happening anymore, mm-hmm. and people in border regions in this country are starting to feel increasingly concerned.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Rachel in McKinney. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Lisa, I've been a fan of yours since you were on Channel 1. It was in my high school, so I appreciate you doing that. It's inspiring to a lot of kids.
Oh, thanks.
And I remember AJ Hammer as well, who clearly took a different journalistic approach later in life.
Right.
But my question is, at that time, what was your inspiration for going into journalism so young? And I can take my call off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
When I was a kid, and I'll talk about this tonight at the Performing Arts Center, I wanted to be on TV because I thought if I can somehow get on TV, I can have a better life. I grew up without a lot of money in a very non-diverse community, and it wasn't until I got a job as a young reporter at Channel 1 that my life was turned upside down. And Channel 1, for those of you who don't know, is a show that's seen in schools across the country, in middle schools and high schools. And when I got the job at Channel 1, they were hiring young 18, 19-year-olds to go report stories because they wanted to appeal to the high school audience. In fact, Anderson Cooper, who's on CNN, was one of my colleagues at Channel 1. But it was when I was 21 years old and sent to cover a story in Afghanistan that changed my life forever. The things that I saw there so shocked me. The world that I experienced there was so foreign and fascinating and concerning to me that my desire went from being on just wanting to be on television to wanting to communicate these stories. Because I came back from that trip to Afghanistan, I tried to talk to people about it, and nobody had any idea that what I experienced even existed in the world, despite the fact that the United States was so deeply involved in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s. And what I saw there had a direct correlation to the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. I thought, you know what? Somehow someone's given me this chance to see this. Now I have to try and communicate the story. I have to try and tell the world what I just saw. And that was in 1994. And even at that time, I thought to myself, somehow this isn't going to be the last time we hear about Afghanistan. And here we are now in this quagmire. And I feel like if more journalists were covering that story in 1994, we might not be in the situation that we are in now, because I don't think this sort of caught us by surprise, 9/11, and the fact that Osama bin Laden was being harbored in Afghanistan. So that to me is a glaring example of the need to have correspondents in the world, you know, as our eyes and ears.
We've spoken pretty critically this hour about the nature of broadcast journalism these days, but I wonder if you would talk about the advantages of television as a medium for communicating what's going on in the world.
Well, television is our biggest source of information. It's in our own homes. We feel close to it. You know, the people that we watch on television, we feel like we know them much more than in films because they're in our homes. And unfortunately, while I think there should be a responsibility for news organizations to actually report substantive news, in this country, with the exception of the PBSs, the NPRs, all news channels are upheld to the same rating system that Fear Factor and these other shows are held to. And so they have to compete for advertising dollars. And it's really unfortunate that news has to adhere to any kind of rating system, period. Because when you have to get ratings, you have to tell stories a little bit more salaciously, or, you know, you have to sex things up a little bit. And unfortunately, that seems to be the state of most of our news broadcasts.
Do you think ProPublica can work?
I do. I really do. I mean, it works in other countries. I mean, it works in England. So I really do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mike in Lake Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hey, hi. So many questions now on what I've just heard. It's a great interview, Lisa. Thank you very much. I was originally just going to comment on the benefits of people traveling abroad. I escaped from England about 20 years ago, and I guess it's almost the same country, separated by a different language. But my daughter took a year off back in 2000, having got up the corporate ladder and benefited from it immensely. A comment you made earlier reminded me. She went back to Britain and got hired by a multinational and probably wouldn't have hired her if she hadn't had that experience. So I'd like to recommend that, having two daughters, to all the girls. But some of the things you've just been saying make me question whether you could recommend sending anybody, especially a woman, abroad, and what sort of security arrangements have to be addressed for somebody to do that, like yourself, like when you go to these dangerous places, including Mexico now.
Right. That's a great question. I wouldn't recommend that people, young people in particular, go to Afghanistan or Iraq or certain parts of Mexico, although there are other parts of Mexico that I visit with regularity, given that I live in California, and there are a lot of safe places, safe parts of Mexico. I don't know that I would recommend cities like Juarez very readily. But to your point about the travel, I try to really encourage young people before they are encumbered by a mortgage or a spouse or a job to go out there and immerse yourself in the world. Even though I was able to travel a lot during my younger years, my biggest regret in life is not living overseas for about a year like your daughter did and immersing myself in another culture and with another language. It's still to this day my biggest regret. And young people, I guarantee, you know, I feel like right now, especially in this unpredictable economy, young people are really nervous about getting jobs. And I understand that, but I truly believe that if you spend time overseas, you will become more marketable to people. Your horizons will be broadened. You'll have more things to talk about with important people. You will be more self-possessed, more poised. And I just cannot underscore the importance of doing so, if you can, enough, because it really, to me, was the best education I have ever gotten. And these days, young people are going to college with the specific goal of getting a job. I feel like if you go and spend some time and live overseas, you will have a plethora of jobs from which to choose, because your perspective will just have been widened enormously. And as scary as it is, you may go to a place and be living there and just hate it, hate the food, hate the conditions. But what I always do when I'm overseas in a place that is challenging, I always think to myself, this is going to be the most amazing experience in retrospect. And I will tell you that as difficult as a lot of my trips have been, there isn't a single one that I have regretted taking, because every single trip has expanded my awareness.
What do you think, Lisa, that people misunderstand about the nature of your job?
What do they misunderstand? I think they think that it's a lot more It's tough, you know, and I think that people think that it's glamorous because it's on television and that we're really highly paid and so on. I mean, I've been very, very lucky to be able to make a living and a fairly decent one. But if you want to pursue journalism to become rich and famous, I strongly suggest that you seek out another career. But if you're passionate about telling stories and if you are an intrinsically curious person, I don't think that there's a better job because you, in a sense, become a mini expert in so many different things. And it's always like that every day. And that's really exciting.
Is there a favorite region of the world that you really like to cover?
There isn't a favorite. I think the reason why I'm fairly decent at what I do is because every story becomes my favorite at the time. I mean, I love Tibet. I love Bolivia. I love, for some reason, I love countries at high altitudes because both Bolivia and Tibet, La Paz and Lhasa are very at high altitudes. So there really isn't one particular region per se. I just, any place that I've never visited is a terrific learning experience for me.
Do you ever think about that and think, I haven't been to Chile and I'm going to find out what I need to cover there so that I can get down there?
Yeah. Yeah. And I try to actually cover stories in places because it's a very different experience going as a tourist and going as a journalist. Because as a journalist, you have to get really immersed. You don't have time to just sit and lay on a beach or go shopping. I mean, you can maybe fit periods of that into your trips, but you have to really engage with people and talk to people. And it makes a big difference. And so, yes, I do try and figure out where there are stories geographically that haven't been told. And I've covered a lot of ground, but there certainly are no shortage of countries that I would like to visit and stories that I'd like to tell.
The last thing I want to ask you about, we have about 40 seconds left, is how your understanding of what your job is has evolved in 18 or 20 years.
Well, I think that because my work is a little bit different looking and feeling than a lot of journalism that you might see on television, I think there's a certain expectation of me. I think people understand that I'm trying to take them along on a journey, and I take that very seriously, and I hope that I am able to deliver a fruitful experience to the people who respond to my work.
Lisa Ling is in town to appear tonight at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas as part of the Brinker International Forum Series. You can find information about that at attpac.org. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was great. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.